910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Severson. A cyber attack delayed tonight's chat on X, formerly Twitter, of the social media company's owner Elon Musk and Donald Trump. When it got started, they talked about the former president getting shot at a rally.
I didn't know I had that much blood. The doctors later told me that the ear is a place that is a very bloody place if you're going to get hit. But in this case, it was probably the best alternative you could even think about.
The FBI says it's investigating allegations that sensitive documents from Mr. Trump's presidential campaign were stolen in a cyber break-in. Hezbollah militants in Lebanon fired dozens of rockets into northern Israel today, say Israeli officials, most shot down by Israeli missiles. The surprise Ukrainian offensive into Russia by thousands of troops has expanded to another region, Kursk first and now Belgorod. Both places were used to launch attacks on Ukraine. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Nitrate is the most common health-related contaminant found in Wisconsin's groundwater, and you can get your well tested for free. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources will be providing free well water testing for nitrate at Farm Technology Days in Cadott, August 13th through 15th. Environmental groups in Wisconsin are urging voters to reject two proposed amendments to the state constitution in Tuesday's primary election. If approved, the amendments would give the Republican-led legislature power to allocate certain federal funds instead of the governor. Melissa Johnson of the nonpartisan organization Green Fire worries these changes would make it harder to use state resources to address climate change-fueled storms or to build green infrastructure.
We're in competition with other states who have streamlined processes to get that money. I don't think Wisconsin wants to wait.
And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Milwaukee County Board Chairwoman Marcelia Nicholson.
The moment I walked out of the auditorium, I said, it's our time now. It's the little girls that look like me who wake up with brown skin and sometimes wonder, do they matter? To have someone like Kamala, who is not only qualified, but representative of voices that have been ignored for far too long, it felt like all things are possible.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. I'm sure you saw over the weekend, ProPublica did a deep dive into Project 2025. Some unearthed videos of, you know, crazy people talking about doing crazy things, reshaping our government. Now, remember, these are the people who say, we love our country. We love the country, but we want to change everything about it. We love America, but we want to change literally everything. There's nothing evidently that they don't want to get their little fingers on and, well, destroy. Now, again, their thought process is we want to go back to the good old days, you know, where, you know, certain people knew where their place was, as I've been saying, you know, blacks, you know, back in the fields, gays back in the closet, women back in the kitchen. And this is where they want to take us. And they're open, honest, and very transparent about it. So ProPublica does this nice little bit of going through and saying, you know, this is how they're planning on creating this ready-made government for Donald Trump, because they realize he doesn't really know what he's doing. They realize he's incapable of actually being a leader, so they're going to do it for him like he's used to, someone doing his homework for him. So, you know, I look at this and I keep coming back to this place of they keep talking about patriotism. They keep talking about love of country. But what is it that they love about the country? And, you know, you look at, you go through the 900-page document. and you look at all of the things that they want to change, there isn't much, I guess. They want this country to be a theocracy. And I've said this for years on the program. They're gonna make Sharia law, a Christian version of Sharia law, great again. We're going to browbeat people. We're going to publicly shame people. And we're going to threaten them with religion. But moreover, what we're going to do is we're going to use government, an activist government, against the citizenry. Now, remember, these are the people who told us that they believe in small, less intrusive government. They want government so small they can drag it in the bathtub and drown it, unless it's one that they control. And I look at this moment that we're in. They're exposed. We've got the documents. The papers are there. The videos are there. There are tons of these videos. I forget how many hours ProPublica said, hours and hours of crazy video of these people talking in detail and in depth about how they're going to eviscerate climate change from every document our government has. And one of my favorite comments was a guy by the name of Dan Huff. They got a video of him. He was a former legal advisor to the White House Presidential Personnel Office under the Donald of the Trump. And he said in one of the videos that I found interesting, he's like, if you're not on board with helping implement a dramatic course correction because you're afraid it'll damage your future employment prospects, it'll harm you socially. Look, I get it, he says. That's a real danger, a real thing. But please, please, do us all a favor and just sit this out. So your patriotic duty in their world is nothing. Kind of reminds me of George W. Bush going, your patriotic duty is to go shopping. Now it's to do nothing but allow them. The people who brought us the wonders of January 6th, the people who tried to overthrow the last election, those people, give them the ability to just do what they're going to do, to dramatically course correct. And for you just to sit by and let it happen. Because, that's the best thing you can do. Because if you're afraid that, treason will look bad on your record, if you're afraid that destroying the government agency that you've been charged with running, you think that'll look long-term bad on your resume, just remain silent and sit this one out. That's what they're calling for. And this is that moment where people of conscience, and look, Republicans, this means you. This is your party. These are your folks. This is your ilk, your brethren. These are those folks. Now, you look at the document. They're kind of running a little bit, not releasing the book. Trump is trying to distance himself, even though his vice president, his vice presidential candidate, has written the foreword for the book. His fingerprints are all over it. All Trump's people's, palm prints are, they're pawing at it, because they all believe that this is their chance. This is their moment. This is that moment where they can make history, where they can be the trifold hat, the founders of the new America. And that should frighten us who love America now, because they see things a little differently than the rest of us. And they are ready to, what's the word again? Course correct dramatically and drastically. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, Sarah Burris is gonna be here to share some thoughts on her work over at Raw Story. Right back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some interesting news over the weekend. Maybe you heard about it. Maybe you heard that the Trump campaign claiming they were hacked. Now, I got to tell you, first reaction, not hacked. First reaction, leaked. Some low-level staffer, somebody angry, someone maybe you know did get ketchup thrown at him, you know, during one of the tirades, something leaked it. But we'll see, They're claiming it's the Iranians who have hacked into their internal communications. Now look, Trump's completely fine. He doesn't email, so there's probably not going to be anything with his name on it. But the campaign and all of the things that people are saying about him and to him and. Well, here to share some thoughts on what all of that could mean. And understand, this is the third election in a row that you've had foreign actors hacking into presidential campaigns. I've been here to share some thoughts. Our good friend, Sarah Burris, reporter at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website, if you want to take a look at their work. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, how the heck are you?
Good. So are you buying the Iranian hack job or... Maybe, I don't know, low-level staffer leaked everything because he got ketchup on his shirt?
Well, that's the other thing that I think is interesting is they said that it came from a phishing thing, which basically meant that some idiot clicked on a link. And this is the thing, right, that we tell our grandparents over and over and over again. Like, if you're going to use email, do not click on anything ever. And, you know, so I don't know. I mean, this is basically exactly the same thing that happened to what's his face from 2016. Oh, God, I can't remember his name, but the dude who basically clicked on the same link. And but it also happened to the Trump campaign in 2016. Remember when the Russians basically hacked both the RNC and the DNC?
I do.
They just didn't release any of the RNC stuff. So they've had it forever, right? I don't know if that has happened this time around. I assume that the Harris campaign has all of the security in place, but who the heck knows? And maybe that's why the Trump people evidently don't, is they have never, they've always had the hackers on their side, maybe. I'm not really sure.
And this is the interesting part of this, because as you pointed out, you know, back in 2016, you know, there were emails that got hacked. And I remember a presidential candidate going, hey, Russia, if you're listening, send it.
And the thing is that it may very well not be a foreign entity because Trump has lost a couple of people in the last week or so, like Nick Fuentes, the Nazi guy. Or white supremacist or one of those.
Yeah, when you lose when he loses the white supremacist base, that's troublesome.
Yeah, I bet he did not see that coming. Ayo. Sorry. Nick Fuentes, Joe Rogan, and Trump is hacked as hell about the Joe Rogan thing. Like, he is not happy about that. Don't you know ketchup was flying? And then one other guy that I never even heard of. So, I mean... he's starting to lose people. Almost lost Kyle Rittenhouse, but they spread some rumor about him that he was going to be a transgender girl, and so he freaked out and came back on board.
No, it wasn't even the transgender girl thing. It was the money. You know, he needs to be able to fleece the flock, and when the flock is coming after you, you got to figure out a way to backpedal so that you can keep cashing those checks.
Well, I think the question is, like, how much money are you going to be able to bilk out of this, right? Like, you killed two people. How many people are going to support you from the MAGA world for the rest of your life? Like, you got to come up with some job at some point, dude. Like, he's like, what, 12 or something? He's really young.
His job is to go around to, he's on the circuit of these right-wing conventions and conferences and, you know, all of these meetings. He does a lot of speaking gigs where the right wing takes care of their own with fairly, you know, nice speaking gigs. And you can, I guess, make a living doing it. I guess it's what he's been doing. It beats working, I guess.
They certainly don't do that for the left.
No. There is no money on the left. Right. I'll tell you that right now.
I don't know if this was something where maybe they hired some low-level staffer who was a lot smarter than they thought. Or is this a case where, they've got some kind of fanboys from the right-wing nutters who are now all in with Fuentes and anti-Trump, or was it a foreign entity? And I'm sure we'll find out something, but I bet it won't be until after the election.
Yeah. Now, do you agree with Bernie Sanders, who's saying that maybe the MAGA fever has broken, that, you know, maybe we're going to finally get past? Because, look, this is looking like what I had hoped for, that, you know, yeah, you might get some court stuff that's going to happen. He's going to be held accountable on some level. But at the ballot box, the American people, in a sound thrashing, you know, send Trump packing back to Mar-a-Lago or wherever with a sound thrashing at the ballot box. A total repudiation of everything that he stands for. Because, look, I've been seeing some of the videos of these MAGA rallies, and people are leaving about halfway through just going, I can't take it anymore.
So one of the things that I feel like we haven't talked much about is that Trump, you know, has kind of gotten a pass from all of this whole, you know, the guy's too old, he's maybe mentally unstable, like something ain't right upstairs. We talked about Joe Biden being unable to tie his shoes for 3 weeks, and Trump held a press conference this week that was a catastrophe. And I mean, the miracle is that the dude didn't light the podium on fire, right? But he lit everything else on fire.
I got through about half of that, and I checked out about halfway through because I'm like, you need new material. I've heard this already.
Fair. I sat there because I was immobilized with my jaw on the floor. And I mean, it's kind of like what happened with the National Association of Black Journalists, where I just didn't expect it to go that bad. And I don't know if it's because I assumed that he had more self-awareness out of somewhere than he ever has in his life. But I think I thought that there were people at Mar-a-Lago, that there were staffers at Mar-a-Lago. And one of the things that one of the pundits on TV said is, you know that nobody was there because just the podium itself showed it was a Mar-a-Lago club podium. Like, at the very least, if you had a staffer on the ground, they'd be putting the Trump campaign placard in front of him. So it may just very well be that he is completely alone and left to his own devices in Mar-a-Lago by himself. And maybe that's why, you know, he was basically allowed to go on forever. But I mean, the story that I heard, and who knows if this is true, right, is I think they were saying that he was trying to prove to his staff, oh, I know how to do this. Yeah. You know, I'm just going to call a press conference and I'll fix this. Right. And I don't know if that's actually what happens, but it seems like something that he may have said, right? Like, oh, I know how to fix this. And just go out there and just. So I don't know that the dude has much more that he can do. The thing is, too, that he's been running for over a year. So they've had all of these rallies and all of these red states and these places. And so I don't know how you get his base more enthusiastic enough to stand in a, you know, 95 degree heat and for hours and hours and hours to wait and stand there in more heat in a rally of a bunch of people where, you know, gunfire might go off. It just doesn't seem like. Ain't nobody got time for that.
No, look, I'm with you. I think he has peaked too soon, and we're now seeing that that tumbling happening, which is why the white supremacist guy was saying, I think they're headed for a catastrophic loss, because there is no new material. they have no idea how to deal with Kamala Harris. I saw a commentator said that, she's in his head. Yeah, she's living rent-free in between his ears because they have no clue how to deal with her or Tim Walz.
Yeah, and I get not being able to figure out Tim Walz because the dude is just the sweetest guy in the world. Like, the memes that are going around online are all about, one of my favorites was Tim Walz is the guy who mows your lawn when you're out of town, or he puts your garbage cans for you out whenever you're out of town. Like, stuff like that. Yeah. I mean, that is very, that's the kind of thing that people in normal America really connect to. And yeah, I mean, Kamala Harris is really, really smart. As much as he wants to pretend that she's an idiot, if he wants to keep lowering that bar, I say good on ya. Because the second they get into that debate and she just smashes him like a bug, he's done.
Yeah.
I mean, all she has to do is basically go in there and make a couple of good policy points, and she's won because he's lowered the bar so much about her.
Yeah, I liked, she was at one of the rallies and there were people screaming other things. She's like, I'm talking now.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really, that kind of motherly, I'm talking now kind of tone, which I find interesting.
And honestly, that's what she did during the vice presidential debate with Mike Pence. That was really effective because Mike Pence is generally, a relatively normal Midwestern guy. He just happens to be really far right and a little bit loony. But whenever it came to her, he just kept trying to talk over her, and she would not allow it. She was just like, I'm talking. Do you want to let me finish? I mean, it was very, it was like that. It was like the smarter big sister putting down her little brother, I mean, it was really good.
I think we're finally starting to see the first Gen X presidential candidate and vice presidential candidate who, they don't play Mother May I. I thought one of Hillary's problems was, she was the smartest person in the room, but, she was prim and proper and by the rules instead of, just going full, what was that idiotic comment they kept saying? When they go low, we go high. Yeah. No. When they go low, you stomp them into the dirt.
That's the thing. That was the Michelle Obama-ism. And I really get why she wants that to be the thing. And I get that it's important to teach our children, to take the high road and all of those things. In politics, and particularly with Donald Trump, it really doesn't work. And, for folks who write about all of the sketchy things that Republicans do all the time, like me, I have a timeshare in the gutter, right? Like, I'm down there. And I got no problems with that. But if you were going to be somebody who is a role model for little girls, like, I get why you want to be a role model for little girls. I think the difference with Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris is that she has sort of mastered, everybody keeps calling it the happy warrior. Like, she has mastered, flattening somebody with a smile. I know that Tim Walz has just been a killer at it because he thinks, he's looks like he's just having a good time, right? He's like Mr. Congeniality, in the beauty contest, right? He's happy to be there. It really has brought, and I think too, like the fact that this has become competitive, Democrats really seem like they are super excited and enthusiastic, and that is coming so late in the process that I don't know where the peak is because I feel like they're still climbing a little bit.
Yeah, no, and we still got a week till the convention, and that you're going to continue to see that climbing happen. The convention, I think you'll hit a stride, and then we'll see what happens after the convention. But in this process,
Is like going down bad.
Exactly. In the process, while they're going up, Trump's still going down, got no bump out of the assassination attempt, got no bump out of the convention, and now is spiraling because they don't have a message. And this has always been Trump's problem. He doesn't have a message outside of fear and smear and hatred. What are you going to do to bring down, you know, energy prices? What are you going to do to bring down food prices? What are you going to do? Oh, we're going to drill, baby, drill. Well, okay. Where?
That's the thing, right? Is Joe Biden has really opened up a lot of new drilling sites and approved a lot of drilling permits more so than other presidents, which is why a lot of the green folks and the climate folks are just incredibly pissed. Because, you know, yeah, he's done a lot of green stuff and supporting solar and wind and all of these things, but he's also been digging into as much oil and gas as he can. And so you have to wonder, like, at what extent can Donald Trump go anymore? Like, are you really going to dig up literally every single ounce of oil and gas that we have? And what happens then when all of those resources are tapped out? You know, like, and we still don't have a plan for,
right,
you know, life after oil.
Well, that'll be somebody else's problem. All they care about. And this is the problem with people with the short-term thinking of our politics.
Yeah.
You know, I just got to get through the next, you know, year or two or three or four. And I don't care.
Next election. They just got to get through the next election.
That's it.
Basically it.
And this is why we don't get things fixed. Yeah. I got to get your thoughts on the near fatal helicopter crash. I guess there's been a bunch of these, right? There have been a bunch of Trump's, you know, almost been killed. He's averted death numerous times in the helicopters.
Oh, man. So this all started with his story at the press conference where he talked about being on a helicopter with Willie Brown, who was a former speaker in California years and years and years ago, but a big deal. And Kamala Harris dated him. And so he tells this story that he and Willie Brown were in this near fatal helicopter accident when he was trashing Kamala Harris to him. The problem is that they were never in a near helicopter crash. And when somebody asked Willie Brown about it, bless him, he just was like, no, and laughed like, oh, that like really infectious, hilarious laugh where you're just like, oh, that's embarrassing, right? Like that, he has embarrassed Donald Trump with that.
And then I saw the comment. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so then it turns out, I mean, basically Gavin Newsom confirmed the same thing where he was just like, yeah, he was in California. I don't know what he's talking about because we didn't have any helicopter problems and the dude couldn't remember the town we were going to. But his biographers all talk about there was a story back way in the day when he had the casino in Atlantic City and he had these executives who were killed in a helicopter crash. And he created this story and there are like six people who worked for him at the time who confirm that he made it up in front of them, that he had a bunch of people in the office and basically muted the phone and said, you guys are going to kill me, but I think I can make something out of this. And then he basically told the reporter who was waiting on the phone, yeah, I almost took that flight, when it was just complete crap.
Yeah. Well, there was another one where I think it may have been Willie Brown who said it wasn't me, but, you know, we all look alike, which I thought was.
Right. Oh, my God. Bless him. Bless him. Love Willie Brown. You gotta love Willie Brown.
So final thoughts. We're heading towards the convention. We're a week away. Any thoughts of what we're going to see? Any ideas on what we should be looking forward to? What are you going to be paying attention to?
Well, one of my favorite things is that Donald Trump said at his press conference is that he wasn't around doing anything this week because of the Democratic convention. So he thought that this week was the convention and didn't know any better. So I want to see what he's doing next week, because if he wasn't going to do anything, you know, last week, is he MIA this week? Is he still on the golf course? I mean, I don't know. I want to know how they're going to respond to this, because I think what we will see from so much of the messaging from speeches that people make is it's going to be that, you know, yes, we can, positive, kind of, we can do this, hope and change message, even though Democrats are in control of the White House now. You know, there still is going to be this hope and this change message where, you know, we don't want to go back. Right. That's the Kamala Harris message.
What I've been saying is they should make the first day and a half all about Joe Biden. This should be an amazing American hero farewell kind of send-off. All the amazing things that he's done. This is the path that Uncle Joe set us on, and we're picking up the mantle, and we're gonna move this further down the road and faster than could have ever been imagined. That's where my mind goes, because I think you got a good foundation. We got that infrastructure bill. We're doing something on reshoring manufacturing. There's a lot of things going on. We're going after the Googles and maybe start breaking up some of these big corporations. There's a lot of good stuff, a lot of labor organizing. I say keep that.
Yeah, keep that and talk about what's next, what more we're going to do to follow that mantle.
Going to be interesting. But I look forward to hearing your thoughts during the convention. I'm sure we will be in touch. Sarah, as always, great stuff.
Thank you. Have an awesome week.
You as well. Our good friend Sarah Burris. Make sure you check out their website, rawstory.com, for all the incredible stories that she's working on. Well worth the read. Quick break. Right back.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Any sprinkles out there coming to an end? Mostly clear skies, some patchy fog forming in the overnight. Light winds at lower 50s at daybreak. After the fog, we'll see quite a bit of sunshine, maybe a couple of sprinkles in the afternoon. Highs in the lower 80s. It's 60 at our studios.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
I was in a drive-thru line and forgot to order. I was on the phone, thought I ordered, and just stayed in line and got up to the window. There was no order for me. And I said to the guy, I go, can I just order now? And he was so condescending. And he goes, well, typically what we do, sir, here is we order back at the speaker, and this is where you pick it up. I've never felt so stupid in my entire life.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, exciting day on the presidential ticket information. As you know, we got a VP candidate. I like Tim Walz. But here's the thing. The big issue for a lot of folks, and I heard a little bit of it, big immigration, kind of a big issue. But how we deal with immigration, I think, is just as big of an issue. You know, as I've been saying for years, I do put a lot of blame on past decisions by administrations to cut foreign aid, to back up immigrants coming in, to do a lot of things that, I don't know, maybe we should have done differently. Policy being a big part of this. So we've got this crisis at the border. We've got this situation. And how are we handling it? That's why I've asked Erin Siegel McIntyre to come talk with us. She's an investigative journalist, also a contributor over at Mother Jones. Got a new piece coming out, the Border Patrol's culture of impunity enables bad behavior and sometimes keeps it from public view. That will be released today. Erin, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be
here. So look, you have this influx of people. You've got all of this. I hate to use the word chaos, but you got this chaos going on, and we're not handling it. We're using it as a political football. It seems like the problem is more important than the solution, and it's left on the people who are at the border, the Border Patrol people, the people who are there. How are we doing?
Yeah, you know, Rick, it's chaos is a tough word. I will say that it has been kind of chaotic, I think it's fair to say. And I think many Border Patrol agents would agree, right? Our sort of the trickle-down effects of our outdated, broken immigration policy at the very top level, you know, that creates a lot of complications when it comes to the rank and file agents who are on the front lines, right? You know, in most cases, they are doing the very best they can with limited resources, with continually changing priorities. A lot of them, especially over the past 10 years, have been asked to do things and to, you know, execute in situations that they're not trained for, right? Border Patrol agents are trained to find people, to track people, to apprehend people. You know, they're not trained to care for children in big facilities, for example, like makeshift tents. That's not what most agents signed up to do, nor do they have training for that. Right. And so when we think about, you know, what's going on? Why are things so chaotic? You know, apprehensions now over the past month are, they've dropped, they've halved. Things are much calmer recently. But there is always this up and down, this ebb and flow that agents have to respond to. And, you know, it's tough. The agency's been in a tough place. It's a highly politicized agency. I would argue that many of our elected officials, up to the very top in DC, oftentimes don't actually know what they're talking about when they do things like say, hey, we need 5,000 more agents to work the line. You know, the agency already has an incredibly hard time both recruiting and retaining agents. Every time the force is tasked with like a big ballooning expansion, you know, that creates problems of different kinds. And if we look back to history, which is something I think I'd also argue we don't maybe do enough in this country at times, when we look back to, you know, post-2003, when the Department of Homeland Security was founded, right? That the Border Patrol was reorganized, they got kind of shuttled over to be underneath that new Homeland Security umbrella, and things changed pretty radically. President Bush at the time also called for this big expansion. And so, you know, in order to fulfill that mandate, the agency did what it could, CBP did what it could. They tweaked the hiring standards. Some have described it as dropping the standards, which—
No, they grabbed warm bodies. They grabbed anybody willing.
Exactly.
You know, beggars can't be choosers kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, I mean, ask any police department that needs to expand quickly. You know, if you're not hiring the best candidates, if your vetting is even a little bit subpar, you're going to have to carry the consequences of that down the road. And more often than not, it's not very pretty.
No. And this is where I think your investigative report is important, because as you point out, over the last, I guess it's the last two decades, you've had 186 alleged incidents of sexual harassment, sexual assault, rape, other things, you know, not just, you know, committed by, but perpetrated against Border Patrol agents. This is a problem.
It is. And that specific data set is, quite frankly, the tip of the iceberg. The problem is determining, well, how big is that iceberg, right? I know for a fact, so this data set, these 186 incidents are, you know, alleged crimes, misconduct of a sexual nature. A lot of different stuff falls under that umbrella. But I know that CBP and the federal government weren't really going through the details very carefully when they compiled that list, which, you know, I obtained via Freedom of Information Act request, right? There's laws that are around that guide how information is released.
Right.
And there are quite a number of very high profile incidents that have been reported in the media, mainstream media, that are not on that list. There are some glaring omissions. So that's what I mean when I say it's sort of the tip of the iceberg. I know it's not complete.
Because I was going to ask you, I go, you know, 186, obviously for those people is a big number, but over a 20-year period, you know, 186, given the kind of power disparity, given the kind of situation that it is, seems like a very low number. Yeah. You know, given the, again, I go back to that power dynamic of you've brought all these people in to control desperate people. It seems to me that there could be a recipe for much worse, a bigger disaster, if you will.
Yeah, you know, and I think what I've learned in my reporting and my research over the past 10 years on this agency is that what we know really isn't the whole picture, especially when it comes to misconduct and criminal behavior by agents and wrongdoing, right? It's, you know, any government agency, any company, any corporation for that matter, they're always going to try to spin when bad things emerge, right? And the Border Patrol, I mean, they're pretty good at it simply because they are able to be so evasive. As a reporter for this recent piece for Mother Jones Magazine, I worked on it for over a year. And CBP, the parent agency of the Border Patrol, they refused to make a single Border Patrol agent available for me to talk to.
Wow.
And so that's really common. And so reporters have to kind of go around that, which is also really hard. It puts agents who are currently working for the government in a really tough spot, right? They could lose their jobs by talking to press without permission from their bosses, right? Are they going to want to ask their bosses for permission? In a lot of cases, no. That creates, you know, a little bit of internal conflict that most folks don't want to deal with. On the flip side, a lot of agents want to talk about their experiences. I would argue they deserve to be able to talk publicly about what they see, what they experience. Their hands are tied in a lot of cases.
And this is one of those things that I keep saying that, you know, you look on the national level and the political realm, the problem is much more important than the solution. And what I mean by that is it, you know, each side has got their constituent base and their funding streams, and keeping this an issue is keeping an industry going. Whereas if we were to actually solve this problem, if we'd actually come up with a solution and solve it in a certain way, the problem might go away. And then all of that funding stream, all of that division, all of that red hat, blue hat stuff might go away. Or am I just being, you know, hopeful?
You know, it's a tough question, right? I think we have to be hopeful. I think we, as a country, it all goes back to what the public wants, right? What is the United States of America? What do we represent? What do we want to represent, right? Is this a land where we do welcome people, refugees, migrants, folks that just want to work in, let's say, a chicken plant, right? Work in jobs that we can't fill with American labor. There's a huge labor question around this, right? And our immigration policy is not really informed by that. You can look at the different kinds of visas, from, you know, the real fancy ones for inventors and for the really rich folks that are going to come here and try to create businesses, all the way down to like H-2B, H-2A visas for what used to be for temporary farm workers, stuff that doesn't really exist anymore. There are so many problems in so many ways, and it is political kryptonite. Nobody will touch this issue because it is wildly unpopular. It's hard to understand. And most Americans just hear this rhetoric all the time that does come from both sides of the aisle around what immigrants are going to do or what immigration does to our workforce or our economy. There's so much misinformation. It makes it really hard to see through all the cloudiness and understand, hey, what do we need to be doing? Where should we focus our attention? And beyond that, what do we want as a country? What should we be asking of our elected officials?
So given this report, because again, you go through and meticulously tell the story of someone who was was raped and you know, kind of, you know, laying out that there's a massive problem in this world. How do we address that? I mean, is this something that the union, because they're represented by a union, is it something that they can do? Is it something that Congress has to do? Is it something that we as people, citizens, have to demand? Where do you see a solution coming here? Or is this just so out of control that maybe this is the best we can do?
So I think when we think about misconduct, and I'm not sure if it's fair to call it a massive issue or if it's better described as a systemic challenge for this federal agency. I think I would fall more on the side of systemic challenge because it's been around for decades, right?
Right.
We've seen it kind of peak, ebb, flow, et cetera, et cetera. But again, without transparency, without fully knowing what's going on, it is really hard to talk about and understand, right? And so when we think about, okay, so what is causing misconduct? Of course, we have to look at hiring and recruitment, but we also have to look at how discipline gets kind of executed at different levels within the agency. We have to look at how things like investigations are resourced, how people are trained, who are tasked with investigating allegations of misconduct. There's a lot of different places where we can look and think about ways to do better. And I think those have to be done sort of in conjunction with each other. It's not like a simple, here's a Band-Aid that will kind of fix everything. It's a bigger issue, yeah.
No, you're saying it's systemic. I know a lot of people say, well, bad apples. Couple of bad apples doing bad things. Because in any large organization, you're gonna have a couple of a-holes walking around who are gonna do bad things. Can it be forgiven as that? Or as you've said, is this something that is systemic that can be dealt with by additional funding, by additional resources, by more transparency, accountability, that kind of stuff?
That's a really good question, Rick. And it's funny that you use the phrase bad apples, right? Because that's the phrase that the Border Patrol and CBP itself uses whenever there is a high profile incident that is too messy or too bombastic or too heinous to kind of contain, and it gets out into the press and the public learns about it. They do tend to rely on this bad apple narrative with the press, which kind of insinuates that, hey, any incident is singular. You know, this is a question, again, of maybe a rogue cop or an agent gone bad. And I think I would argue at this point, based on my research, based on my reporting, and all of the agents and former agents I've talked to, I don't think we're actually talking about apples here. I don't think it's accurate to say it's a bad apple here and there. I think the workplace culture, I think it's better to describe it like this, right? The Border Patrol agents, they're more like pickles and they're in a jar, right? That jar, there's a bunch of different jars. Every sector has its own shape, size, and brine, right? But all of these agents are in this culture. They're the brine is seeping in, they're in this atmosphere. The workplace culture might turn a blind eye to certain kinds of conduct and behavior. It really depends on your station, who you are, who you're friends with. There's a lot of factors at play. Discipline for one kind of offense in, let's say, Tucson sector might be different from the way San Diego sector handles it. It kind of depends on a lot of factors again. And so, you know, the characteristics of the workplace are not uniform, and it makes it a really complicated issue to A, grasp, and B, try to push in a way towards reforming anything.
Now, I got to imagine, because, look, I believe the majority of Border Patrol agents want to come and do their job and do the best that they can, and they want to serve the country, and they want to do all those high-minded things that we hope and want from them. And yet there are some that are your bottom feeders. I think they want changes. I think they want better training, better accountability, more transparency, all that stuff. Or again, am I just being overly hopeful?
No, you're not being overly hopeful, right? It's a workforce like any workforce. But, you know, what's different, I think, about the Border Patrol in particular is the fact that it is a job where, you know, you are holding a significant level of power. Right? You are on the front lines. It's a position that is very susceptible to bad actors trying to bribe agents to do things like pass people through checkpoints, to smuggle drugs. It's a highly corruptible position. And so these agents have to be really, really carefully vetted, carefully trained. You have to have a certain fortitude to make it as an agent in a lot of different ways, but that includes standing up to some of the temptations that might come across while you're doing your job. And so, you know, is it a workforce that just has, like you were saying before, more bad apples? I don't think so, but there is a lot of temptation and there are systemic problems. They come from somewhere. And it does go back to the workplace culture, goes back to training at the academy as well. And it goes back to, again, how discipline is handled, how supervisors are trained. There's a lot of factors at play here.
No, I see. I'm going to be more along the lines of these type of jobs attract certain kind of people. And some of those people overwhelmingly have power trip issues, have control issues. And when you have this kind of imbalance in power, or where you have someone who has power and obviously people who have none, that is a recipe for disaster. So out of this investigative report that you've done, what are you hoping comes out of this? Because I can see that people are going to attack this going, well, you're just taking cheap shots at the Border Patrol officers. So what's the hope out of this?
Yeah, you know, I think nothing in this piece or in my work takes any cheap shots at anybody whatsoever. I think it's fair. And I think what I write about and report is absolutely accurate. And so I do it through a lens of empathy for agents, because there are quite a number of agents who, you know, when somebody commits a heinous crime, let's say when somebody murders a prostitute, right, that's a Border Patrol agent, that tarnishes the badge for everybody else. That's not something agents want to live with, right? Nobody wants to have bad cops in their midst. It's a problem everybody knows exists, and it does deserve a solution. And so I think my hope for doing articles like this A, are that the conversation advances a little bit and that we can talk about some of these systemic issues. We can talk about how complaints are handled or not handled. And we can start talking about what we can do better instead of just treating the Border Patrol like they're either all villains or all heroes, because quite frankly, it's a very big gray area. And there are a lot of agents too that would say, we need to do better. Why does this keep happening?
It's the same thing with law enforcement overall. That's the whole reason when they were doing that whole defund the police nonsense. I was going, no, I support the police when they're not wrong. When they're wrong, we hold them accountable like we would with anyone else. And the same thing with the Border Patrol officers. I support them 100% when they're not doing wrong.
Right. And that, Rick, that's where I think the role of the press really matters here. And it's so frustrating because it is so hard to report on the Border Patrol. It is so hard to crack through the green wall and get actual information that, you know, when we talk about accountability, when we talk about, you know, helping police agencies do better, we can't do any of that unless we know what's going on.
There you go. Aaron, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great report. Hope folks will take a look at it. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at Crossing the Line, the Border Patrol's Culture of Impunity Enables Bad Behavior and Sometimes Keeps It from Public View, written by Aaron Siegel McIntyre. Aaron, I appreciate the time. I'd love to talk to you again sometime down the road.
Sounds great, Rick. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Want to hear your thoughts. I know this is gonna generate a lot of email. So angry stuff to the top. As always, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Want to hear your thoughts. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1890. That was the day that one of the heroines of the U.S. labor movement, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, was born in Concord, New Hampshire. Elizabeth learned her progressive politics at a young age. Her father was a socialist and her mother a feminist. Elizabeth was kicked out of high school for speaking out in favor of socialism. This did not slow her down. She kept speaking and her reputation grew. She became a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. She traveled the country organizing and speaking to workers. From the Minnesota Iron Range to the textile mills of Lawrence, Massachusetts, Elizabeth was on the front lines of the labor struggle. She was arrested for her activity 10 times, but was never sentenced. During World War I, Flynn was arrested and stood trial for speaking out against the war. The experience led her to become one of the founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, an organization dedicated to protecting freedom of speech. In the 1930s, Flynn became a member of the U.S. Communist Party, writing a regular column for the Daily Worker. But despite her personal political ideas, she supported Democratic Party President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944. During the 1950s, she was caught up in the anti-communist hysteria led by Senator Joe McCarthy. She went to prison for 2 years for allegedly violating the Smith Act, a law against overthrowing the government. She died while on a visit to Russia in 1964. More than 20,000 people attended her funeral there. A monument to Flynn stands at the Forest Home Cemetery just outside of Chicago, where she is buried alongside the graves of Eugene Dennis, Big Bill Haywood, and the Haymarket Martyrs. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So on Monday, you had the D.C. Circuit Judge who said Google, Monopoly, historic. I mean, this is a big, big freaking deal. The first time in, a quarter of a century that we've gone after one of these monopolistic corporations and said, hey, you're breaking the law. And we'll see what the remedy will be. For me, it should be about breaking this up and creating more competition, doing away with the non-compete agreements, which, understand, the courts are about ready to block and make non-competes great again, so that these big corporations can hold people hostage in their ranks for menial bits of information, so that the knowledge that they might gain from employment, the expertise that they may have gotten through a career of working for different places, will never turn into a new business. And you know, that's how big corporations like it. Now, with the Google thing, and as I said, this is kind of a big freaking deal, that you had this judge come out and say, yeah, they're breaking the law. Now it's time to maybe look at some other things. And I said on Tuesday, look, we should be going after these big grocery chains. We should be going after all of these industries that are controlled by 2-3 corporations, maybe 4. We should be going after that and recreating local businesses and more competition instead of these giant behemoths that, well, there's no real competition. It's more like, you know, algorithmic collusion. And the other place that we should be looking at is our media. The fact that you have these huge, you know, media conglomerates, you have this mass consolidation, and understand our media has been systematically dismantled from the Reagan era forward with the end of the Fairness Doctrine, all the way up to Bill Clinton signing the Telecom Bill of 96 that allowed for the ownership of, you know, it used to be that you couldn't own a radio and TV station in the same market. It used to be that you couldn't own a newspaper and you couldn't own a bunch of things that you had, you know, sole coordination of message. Now, understand, the media companies, what they want is they want to be able to own the local TV station, the radio station, and what used to be newspapers. And what they would do is they would fire, you know, 2 of the 3 reporters, and they would just replicate that one reporter's work across all 3 platforms, saving them a boatload of money. Good for the bottom line, good for profits. Now, the industry, well, screw them. Because I read somewhere where someone said, look, you know, in my lifetime, and this is my lifetime, he's talking about that we went from having twice as many reporters to multiples more population. So we've got less reporters, more people. And I look at, you know, companies like Sinclair Broadcasting. There was a great commercial done a couple years back where they took all of the local hosts of the Sinclair Broadcasting Network and they pieced together, you know, a commentary that was given to all of them to read across the board. And it was kind of eerie to see that you had all of these different local people that you think are, hey, it's you and me, buddy. You know, saying something that in every market is being repeated. That is a bit Orwellian. But for me, this is an opportunity to use some of this power to break up, you know, Big Pharma, break up some of these big conglomerates, and our media being a big part of that. Bringing some bit of local back. Bringing some bit of actual reporting back. Now, I know in the age of the internet, I hear this all the time. We got more choices than ever. And maybe we should be looking for more journalistic voices than just the loudest and the most obnoxious who keep telling us the craziest stuff. And I look at this, the attacks on Tim Walz. Quite remarkable. I mean, this is a guy, this is an every guy. This is your neighbor. This is the dad from next door. And they are going to rip into him and try and make everything that's ever happened in this man's life some kind of giant conspiracy, some liberal conspiracy where, you know, Tim Walz is going to tear the country apart. When here's a guy who takes care of his family. Here's a guy who is the dude next door. You know, as I said on Twitter, here's a guy I want to have a beer with, solve all the world problems while we argue over a football game. That's the Tim Walz. And like I said, I think Kamala Harris made the right choice. I think he's a good choice. I think he's someone that people are going to connect with, especially working class voters. And that has got the right losing their minds. Because he's extremely normal. His family is like our family. Here's a guy who I'm sure at one point knew what it was like to have to worry about putting food on the table, keeping a roof over the kids' heads. This is a working class guy who had to roll up the sleeves and, as a teacher, work a second job, had to dig into his pockets for school supplies. This is a guy who's going to bring working class ideals to the public forum. And that's why we should love him for it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. For video, freespeech.org. Everything right there. And hey, you know, thanks for being here. As always, great seeing you. Look forward to seeing you back here again next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.